This is the 11th Schertz Lectureship. I have been privileged to be a part of the last nine of those. It is always an honor to be asked. It is always a privilege to participate. And I hope that I will be able to continue being a part of this great lectureship. The Schertz congregation is very near and dear both to my heart, but to my wife Laura's as well. And I'm so glad she is here with me today. It's the first time in about 4 years she's been able to join me. Laura has a real job, and she unfortunately has to work much of the time, but she was able to take off today, and I'm glad that she was able to accompany me here. Appreciate so much the congregation here. Appreciate the friendship that I've had with Stan Crowley now for about 13 years. Appreciate what he meant to me as I was a student at Southwest, and even more subsequently to that time, and that we've been in full-time work now, although these many years, and I value his advice and his input as we sort of help each other go about the business of laboring in the Lord's vineyard. The speaking serpent in the garden. The universal flood and Noah's building of the ark to, I think I just messed this up, didn't I? Oh boy. Noah's building of the ark to escape it, the parting of the Red Sea, Jonah's being swallowed by a great fish and having to endure being in that fish's belly some 3 days and three nights. All of these capture the fancy and the imagination of our young ones, and perhaps some of us not so young. In fact, even though all of these events that I have described indeed occurred, they often cause the little ones to gasp or stare in awe, as if they were fables. In fact, perhaps they are even in more awe when we assure them that they indeed took place. While perhaps not quite as well known, the events that occurred in Daniel chapter 5 fall into that same category. The handwriting on the wall was a larger-than-life, supernatural event, which served a divine purpose in the overall plan of God. As I was writing this manuscript last spring, I couldn't help but be glad that I was given this assignment, because I had the privilege to write in 2009 for the Studies in Isaiah Volume 1, a manuscript entitled Judgment Against Babylon. And indeed, both of those assignments correlate with one another, because Isaiah wrote of the prophecy. He prophesied against the judgment against Babylon, God's judgment against them, and we find that judgment coming to pass here in Daniel chapter 5. The book of Daniel is renowned for its eloquent prophecy of the Lord Jesus Christ and the glorious church which he built, the church for which he died, as well as the spectacular imagery concerning certain events that would take place in that 400-year period. We sometimes call the silent years, but it is the period between the Old and the New Testaments. God, through numerous prophets, had pleaded with his people to return from the error of their ways, to forsake idols, to turn from wickedness. And yet they would not. In fact, the attitude of God's people could perhaps be summed up in God's expression of anger and frustration through the prophet Isaiah, in Isaiah 30, verses 9 and 10, that this is a rebellious people, lying children, children that will not hear the law of the Lord, which say to the seers, see not, and to the prophets, prophesy not unto us right things, speak unto us smooth things, prophesy deceits. And as a result of their continued defiance, God allowed them to be conquered by foreign powers. The southern kingdom of Judah was conquered by the Babylonian Empire. The Babylonians, also known as the Chaldeans, they took a young man by the name of Daniel into captivity in that first wave of aggression along about 606, 605 BC. You know, Daniel is an intriguing case. Here was an honorable young man who was ever conscious about pleasing God and doing his will, and yet, as the result of the behavior of previous generations that had been unfaithful to God, Daniel and others of his generation found themselves captive and spending virtually their whole lives in captivity. And as captives in Babylon, Daniel and his friends, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, perhaps even better known by their Chaldean names, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they chose to remain faithful and loyal to the God of heaven, and this faithfulness and loyalty was unwavering despite the many trials they faced. And as a result of their faithfulness, God protected them and he blessed them. And although they were captives, they were given positions of authority in the Babylonian Empire. By the time we reach the events of Daniel chapter 5, over 60 years have passed since the deportation of Daniel and his friends. Now, interestingly enough, we read nothing further of Daniel's friends after their ordeal in the fiery furnace, as depicted in Daniel chapter 3. And interestingly enough also, we read nothing of Daniel in that particular chapter. But nevertheless, by now, Daniel is what we would call an elder statesman. And in fact, although he is at this point what we might call sort of put out to pasture, he will again become an important figure, even in the next and subsequent empire, that Medo-Persian Empire will be well respected by the rulers of that regime as well. In Daniel chapter 5, an amazing event takes place. And you know, sometimes we use words like amazing and stupendous and spectacular and tremendous and things of that nature. But I make no mistake about it, I don't believe it's overstated one bit when we use the word amazing for what takes place in Daniel chapter 5. Again, propels Daniel to the forefront, puts him in a position to reveal the will of the God of heaven to a heathen king at odds with that same God. And so as we begin in our text this afternoon, let us consider the first four verses where we find a sacrilegious feast. And there we are introduced to Belshazzar, the king of Babylon. And we're all familiar with Nebuchadnezzar, perhaps the most famous king of this empire. He reigned for about 40 years, and subsequently to his reign, there were some kings that came along in succession, about three of them or so, that were not as well known and who had decidedly shorter periods of in power. And then we find a man by the name of Nabonidus. Now, Nabonidus is not mentioned at all in the book of Daniel, but we know from secular history that he was the father of Belshazzar. There was no blood relationship between Nebuchadnezzar and Nabonidus. The relationship was that Nabonidus had married a daughter of Nebuchadnezzar, and that is how he gained his position. Nabonidus was also known as perhaps a warrior king. He was one who liked to be in the action, liked to be the one to actually lead the troops into battle. And also, secular history records that his ascension to the throne was not very well received. And so as a result of his penchant for wanting to be in the battle and the fact that he was not well received, he appointed his son Belshazzar as a co-regent, and it was Belshazzar who was responsible for sort of the day-to-day ruling of the empire. As the events of Daniel chapter 5 unfold, Nabonidus and the Chaldean army are attempting to withstand the advances of Darius the Mede against the city of Babylon. Now, incredibly, despite the impending peril, Belshazzar decides to host a great feast for 1,000 of his lords. We note verse 1 that he drank wine before the 1,000. Now, the word before here doesn't mean he got the first glass or that he had more than anyone else. It simply meant that he was in a position of prominence where he could be seen, and certainly that would be understandable given his position as king. Now, in verse 2, we find that Belshazzar commanded that the gold and silver vessels that Nebuchadnezzar had confiscated from the temple in Jerusalem be brought in order that he and his guest might drink from them. Now, interestingly enough, we find a time where this was prophesied, that Nebuchadnezzar would indeed take these vessels out of the temple. In Isaiah chapter 39, we find that Hezekiah, the king of Judah, had been ill. And there was a man of Babylon by the name of Merodach-Baladan, who was the son of Baladan, king of Babylon. And he came to Hezekiah to sort of wish him well after his illness. And when Isaiah heard of this, he came to the king, Hezekiah, and he asked this question. Young preachers, I urge you to have this sermon in your repertoire. The words of Isaiah to Hezekiah, Isaiah 39 and verse 4, what have they seen in thine house? That's the question that Isaiah asked Hezekiah. You know what Hezekiah said? They've seen it all. I showed them everything. And Isaiah said as a result, beginning in verse 6, behold, the day has come that all that is in thine house and that which thy fathers have laid up in store until this day shall be carried to Babylon. Nothing shall be left, saith the Lord. And of thy sons that shall issue from thee, which thou shalt beget, shall they take away, and they shall be eunuchs in the palace of the king of Babylon. And that's exactly what happened. They took those vessels, those sacred vessels, and took them off to Babylon. And now Belshazzar is calling for them to be brought. Notice we find in verse 2 that he ordered this whiles he tasted the wine, indicating that he was starting to feel those intoxicating effects of the wine. It has been demonstrated repeatedly the debilitating effects that alcohol has both on the human body and on the human psyche. The consumption of alcohol clouds judgment, removes inhibitions so that the drinker is prone to make decisions they might not make while sober. And so we find in verses 3 and 4 that the vessels were brought per the king's command. The guests began to drink from these, and as they drank, they began to praise their idols. They began to toast them and glorify them and honor them. And I suggest to you that not only did this serve to sort of, in their minds, declare the superiority of their idols, but certainly also to denigrate the true and living God of heaven. The Chaldeans apparently had many idols. As the text says, they had idols of gold, silver, brass, iron, wood, and stone. And so as we move into verse 5, we find that a truly amazing thing occurred. This was something that would have baffled people that were completely sober, let alone those who were becoming increasingly intoxicated. The fingers of a man's hand appeared out of nowhere and began to write on the wall. We can only imagine the horror of seeing such a frightful sight. I wish for just a moment, just put yourself in that banquet hall with all of this revelry going on and picture what it would have been like to see a hand, just a hand, begin to write a message on the wall. And then something else interesting happened. Perhaps what I would suggest to you, maybe as a profound understatement in scriptures as we've ever seen, the king's countenance changed. One can picture the color draining from his face as he watched this hand, not attached to a body, writing on the wall. You know, we're not told the size of the hand. And this is only speculation on my part, but I suspect that because it was a mere hand not attached to a body, that it perhaps was somewhat larger than a normal hand. Furthermore, we find that the king's thoughts troubled him, indicating his extreme fear. We have to wonder what was going on in the mind of Belshazzar. Certainly he was afraid, but what else was he thinking in his alcohol-induced state? We note that he began to sort of lose control of his legs. He was in such fear. You know, I've always heard of people being so frightened that their knees knocked, but I've never seen it personally, but this is what happened to Belshazzar. He was so terrified that his knees began to knock together. Now, before we sort of scoff at Belshazzar and what is occurring here, I suggest to you that who among us would have had a different reaction if we had seen such a frightful sight as this? Belshazzar obviously would have to account for his behavior that led to the revealing of this ominous message, but I suggest to you that his reaction was completely normal, being this frightened over what he is seeing. And in this state of fear and amazement, he calls loudly for the astrologers, the Chaldeans, and the soothsayers to come and interpret the writing on the wall. I think the significance of the term Chaldeans here apparently is that these are individuals who are well-schooled in the language and who would perhaps be counted upon to try to decipher that message that was written on the wall. We find these wise men sort of filing in. They're being shown what has taken place here. And then Belshazzar makes a stunning offer here in verse 7. Whosoever shall read this writing and show me the interpretation thereof shall be clothed with scarlet and have a chain of gold about his neck and shall be third ruler in the kingdom. You know, I remember when I was a youngster and I would hear this story or read these things and I would wonder what the significance of the, what's the third ruler? What does that mean? Well, again, when you understand that Belshazzar was co-regent with his father Nabonidus, that is as high a position as he could have possibly offered to anyone who could do his bidding. But in verses 8 and 9, or at least verse 8, we find that these men were not able to decipher the message. And in verse 9, whatever temporary relief we find that Belshazzar may have experienced when the wise men were called, he apparently had confidence that they would be able to reveal the message to him. They could not. And once again, his countenance changed. Also, we find the reaction of those guests as they too were terrified at what they were experiencing. And so beginning at verse 10, we find Daniel is brought before the king. But before he's brought, we find in verse 10 the queen. Now, the queen is not the queen as in Belshazzar's wife. The language indicates that this is his mother. Sometimes we call her the queen mother. Apparently, she was not present at the feast. Also, she appears to be able to speak to him in a manner in which only a mother could speak to her son. She addresses him in the usual manner of a king, "O king, live forever." And she attempts to sort of soothe him, to calm his fears as a mother would a son. She began to explain to Belshazzar in verse 11 why he need not be so fearful. But you know, interestingly enough, if the queen mother had known the content of the message herself, she would have had every reason to tell Belshazzar that he had every reason to be afraid. Now, even though the king's wise men could not decipher the message, the king did have a subject in his kingdom who could. In fact, according to the queen mother, this man had the spirit of the holy gods. She went on to describe him as having light, understanding, and godlike wisdom. Now, even though the queen mother was speaking from a pagan mentality, she recognized that Daniel had supernatural wisdom and ability. She may have been mistaken as to the source of this ability, but she knew it was beyond mortal man. And she invokes the name of King Nebuchadnezzar. And I suggest to you that she was a witness to some of these things that had occurred earlier concerning King Nebuchadnezzar, such as the dream that he had dreamed that is recorded in Daniel chapter 2, and perhaps also the fact that Nebuchadnezzar was driven from his throne and forced to live as a beast in the field, as recorded in Daniel chapter 4. Furthermore, we note that Nebuchadnezzar had made Daniel the master of the magicians, astrologers, Chaldeans, and soothsayers, Daniel 2 and 48, Certainly Daniel was none of these, but he had been given authority over them nonetheless. And so continuing this description, she began to praise Daniel's integrity as well. No doubt she was impressed by Daniel's excellent spirit, as she referred to it. And most people were impressed by Daniel. Daniel seemed to have a way with people, didn't he? You recall in Daniel chapter 1, Melzar, the prince who was in charge of the educating and the taking care of those young men. And Daniel convinced Melzar to allow him and his friends to eat vegetables and drink water rather than partake of the king's provisions. And of course, later on, we find that Daniel will have a profound influence over yet another king of the Medo-Persian Empire as well. What the queen mother told Belshazzar, her son, was that she could trust Daniel, not only to interpret the message, but not to spare the details in doing so. And so she says, let Daniel be called. And Daniel was summoned. Now in verse 13, Daniel comes in and the king asks if he is Daniel, the one whom Nebuchadnezzar had brought into captivity, lo, those many years ago. And interestingly enough, Belshazzar seems to only have a vague knowledge of Daniel, even after hearing this description from his mother. It has been estimated that Daniel was taken into captivity somewhere mid-teens, late teens, and he had been in captivity, as estimated now, about 65 years, so almost all of his life. And yet the king had only perhaps a cursory knowledge of him. And so he begins to almost parrot the description to Daniel that his mother had given him about his abilities and his character as well as his integrity. In verse 15, he begins to explain the current situation and why he had been called. Now, you know, he didn't tell Daniel that there was a hand that appeared out of nowhere, but he did tell him that there was a message upon the wall, a message that no one could interpret. Interestingly enough, of course, Belshazzar didn't need to tell Daniel about the hand appearing, as Daniel would ultimately prove later on in this chapter. Belshazzar continues to describe for Daniel what he had heard concerning him, and then explains to him that he supposedly can remove doubts and solve and reveal mysteries. And then the king reiterates the promise to Daniel that he had made to the other wise men and astrologers. If he could interpret the message, the king would give him royal clothing. He would put a gold chain about his neck and be proclaimed the third ruler in the kingdom. And beginning at verse 17, we find Daniel's response to the king. First and foremost, he was not interested in the king's reward. Daniel, I suggest to you, felt no compunction for being paid. Number one, he was not doing this for the king. He was doing this because it was God's will that his message be revealed. And that was first and foremost in Daniel's mind. And secondly, I suggest to you that these royal accoutrements would have been of little value to Daniel, especially in a kingdom that was about to be toppled by a foreign power. But once again, Daniel exhibits godly character and integrity. Again, keep in mind that no one of these other astrologers and wise men, soothsayers, they didn't even know what the message said, much less what it meant. A less honorable man certainly could have fabricated a message and tried to obtain those gifts under false pretenses. But before interpreting the message, Daniel decides to give the king a history lesson, the object of which was to, in essence, reprimand him for failure to learn the lessons of history. Daniel somewhat scolded the king here, but he did so in a respectful way. In fact, he acknowledged his kingship, that he was indeed a king, and addressed him as such. He reminded Belshazzar that the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar, thy father, a kingdom and majesty and glory and honor. And I suggest to you this served two distinct purposes, one of which was to inform Belshazzar that the Most High God is the only true God and therefore the ultimate source of any and all blessings. And then secondly, since God was the reason whereby Nebuchadnezzar was able to achieve such remarkable success, it was certainly not because of the idols to whom he was now praising and drinking to, etc. Daniel informed Belshazzar that not only did God bless Nebuchadnezzar with power and authority, but in essence gave him autonomy. The nations of the world were in fear and dread of Babylon. And Nebuchadnezzar, as the ruler of Babylon, more or less held the power of life and death in his hands. God raised Babylon to power because she was necessary to bring about his will and accomplish his design. And Daniel wanted Belshazzar to know unmistakably that whatever power and authority that Nebuchadnezzar had achieved, it was because of God's will that this would occur. But Nebuchadnezzar had become proud. He'd become arrogant. And as a result, God took his power away. It was not surprising that one who ruled so ruthlessly would consider himself to be at some point invincible. And Nebuchadnezzar, as we noted in chapter 4, walked around his palace saying, "I've done all of this myself." And as a result, God drove him from his throne, and he was forced to live as a beast in the field. Nebuchadnezzar was deposed from his throne and driven from the sons of men. He was forced to eat the grass. His body became wet with the dew of heaven. And even beyond that, he became animal-like even in his thinking. He no longer was able to think and reason like a man, but he became sort of instinctive, like an animal in the field. He was forced to live like this until 7 times passed over him, and he recognized that it was the God of heaven who was responsible for the glory and power that he had achieved. And notice in verse 22, Daniel became more pointed in his address to Belshazzar, directly accusing him of pride and arrogance. And despite being aware of what had occurred with Nebuchadnezzar, he had lifted himself up against the God of heaven. You know, friends, it is impossible to imagine how Belshazzar could not have known about the extraordinary events that occurred with Nebuchadnezzar. But yet, Daniel said, even though you knew all of this, you still became prideful and arrogant. He chose to dismiss those things. People do that. They can look back on the lessons of history and they can be going down that same road, but they'll say, well, it won't happen to me because I'm smarter. It won't happen to me because I'll have better luck than my predecessors. But indeed, we all need to learn the lessons of history. Specifically, Daniel accused the king of 4 distinct sins. He defied the Lord of heaven. He desecrated the holy vessels. He worshipped and praised idols, and he failed to glorify the true God. He said about God, "In whose hand thy breath is, and whose ways are all thy ways." And so we reach verse 24, and Daniel is about to interpret the message on the wall. Daniel explains that God, whom Belshazzar had so blatantly defied, so blatantly insulted, had sent the hand to write a message on the wall, and that it is God who is the author of that message. God's plan to send only a hand was certainly designed to get the attention of Belshazzar and to produce the desired response. And so Daniel reads the message. The message was, "Many, many tekel upharsin." And now the next 3 verses contain the interpretation of each portion of the message. Each part of the message is what we would call bifurcated, meaning that there is actually 2 parts to the interpretation. This is most prominently noted in the first word, "many," which appears to be repeated for emphasis. Daniel interpreted this word as, "God hath numbered thy kingdom and finished it." The numbering, of course, is the numbering of days. God had, in fact, numbered the days of this empire before it was even established. The omniscient God knew that Babylon would rise to power and would swell with pride and arrogance, believing themselves to be invincible, and that in that state of overconfidence, they would become vulnerable and ultimately fall. The next word was tekel, meaning thou art weighed in the balances and art found wanting. You know, God has much to say about weights and measurements. In places such as Leviticus 19, Deuteronomy chapter 25, we find God ordered his people, commanded his people to use just weights and just measurements. Belshazzar was weighed in the precise and objective balances of Almighty God and was found wanting. He did not measure up. He was deficient in that measuring. In verse 28, we note a variance between what Daniel translated and his original reading. Daniel translated the word peres, whereas earlier he translated or read eupharsin. Eupharsin is simply the plural of peres. And the translation is the kingdom, or thy kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. The kingdom would not literally be divided. The Medes and the Persians came together to form a coalition, and they would share power. Notice verse 29. Whatever you might say about Belshazzar, you can say this. He was a man of his word. He commanded that Daniel be clothed with the royal garments, the gold chain placed about his neck, and then he proclaimed Daniel as the third ruler of the kingdom. And verses 30 and 31 are very brief, but they describe very quickly the fall of Babylon. That night, Belshazzar, the king of Babylon, was slain. Verse 31 tells us that Darius the Mede ascended to the throne, and he was 62 years old at the time of his ascension. There are some lessons to be learned from Daniel chapter 5, one of which is the word of God is always true. Paul stated in Romans 3 and verse 4, "Yet God, let God be true, but every man a liar." God had been warning his people for decades of the impending doom should they fail to repent of their wickedness. And when they failed to do so, that incurred God's wrath, and he punished them through captivity. But you know, God's judgment is not only for his own people, it's for all of mankind. All who fall short of his glory will face his wrath and his judgment. We note also that nations as well as individuals are subject unto God. Solomon wrote, Proverbs 14:34, "Righteousness exalteth a nation, but sin is a reproach to any people." This has been the case since the beginning of time, and it is still the case today. Make no mistake, folks. If anyone thinks that the United States of America is not subject to this principle right here, they're fooling themselves. We have, for the most part, abandoned the biblical principles and precepts upon which this nation was founded. We have ignored the moral principle that the Bible teaches and have instead embraced immorality and pronounced evil things as good and good things as evil. Isaiah 5 and verse 20. We also ought to learn from the events of the past. Belshazzar certainly should have learned from Nebuchadnezzar, but he did not. Pride and arrogance cause people to think that regardless of what has occurred in the past, somehow it will be different with them. Let us consider also that hiding from problems or pretending that they do not exist will not make them disappear. You can only imagine what was Belshazzar thinking as the enemy is at the gate and yet his solution is to throw a party. But you know, friends, I wonder about some congregations of the Lord's church who, when they're faced with problems, don't deal with them head on. They sweep them under the rug or pretend that they don't exist. Does that ever really work? It might work for a week or two or a month or two, but we need to deal with our problems as they arise. And then lastly, of course, no one can escape the law of sowing and reaping. I'm sure we're all familiar with these two verses. "Be not deceived, God is not mocked, for whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap. For he that soweth to his flesh shall of the flesh reap corruption, but he that soweth to the Spirit shall of the Spirit reap life everlasting." You know, before I close, how much time do I have? Okay, I just want to mention a couple things. You know, skeptics often say things such as, well, you can't take the Bible literally. The Bible is a book of myths, just a bunch of stories, just a bunch of people's opinions and ideas. But I found so many things in Daniel chapter 5 which indicate that the Bible is indeed a reliable source. And I would ask these skeptics, you know, when we think about the cliches and some of the slogans that we use, even yet today in the 21st century, where do they think these things came from? If the Bible is not a truly reliable source. For instance, Belshazzar's reaction to the Medo-Persian army was to simply get drunk and ignore the danger. How many people do we know or have known in our lives that deal with problems the same way? They use drugs, they use alcohol, they use other substances to try to numb the pain, numb the reality, blind themselves to the reality, and simply don't deal with life itself. The phrase, seeing the handwriting on the wall, how many times have we ourselves used that? We use that in politics. He had to withdraw from the Senate race because he saw the handwriting on the wall. There was no way he could win. We use that in sports. We use it in business and other aspects of life as well. It's a common expression used to describe an occasion where there are obvious signs of an inevitable outcome. And also weighed in the balances and found wanting. We use this to describe something or someone that is deficient. It's used in reference to something or someone that has been tested and has failed the test. And then the days that are numbered. God numbered the days of the kingdom of Babylon and finished it. And we often use this phrase and hear this phrase in reference to someone whose tenure in their current position is rapidly approaching its end. Now, finally, we note the character of Daniel. Daniel was consistent in his faithfulness to God. He exhibited extraordinary courage all of his life. Even as a young man, he purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself, Daniel chapter 1 and verse 8. He demonstrated his primary loyalty was to God. And much later, he would demonstrate that loyalty even in the face of death. In between, he boldly interpreted dreams and messages from God to heathen kings that would spell doom for these kings and their empires. Friends, we would do well to emulate the example of Daniel.